T-minus 15 seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
We're going to have a fantastic conversation today with Scott as he shares with us his experience from a mechanical perspective and some of the work he's done on some passive house infrastructure. Enjoy. All right. So Scott, you know, I want to say welcome to the Net Zero to Hero podcast. It is great to have you. And I guess one of the best places to start is just letting you introduce yourself, what you do, where you work, and let's go from there.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Brandon. I am an associate principal at Introba. We are the global mechanical, electrical, and really consulting engineering firm that does more than just consulting engineering. We have a whole policy planning team, research team. We do performance engineering. And honestly, we do quite a wide selection of services, all primarily built around the built environment. And my own story is that I actually am very passionate about green buildings, very much passionate about high-performing buildings. Had moved to Vancouver about 10 years ago, coming up on 10 in about 6 months, and joined the firm prior to the merger called Integral Group, and they're very much kind of leaders in the deep green engineering realm. And I kind of made a commitment to myself that I wanted to work on, you know, essentially high performing buildings, wanted to work with owners that wanted to push the envelope, wanted to kind of really move towards decarbonizing the built environment, but then also wanted to place a focus around, you know, net zero energy, net zero carbon, passive house construction. And yeah, I guess been really lucky and fortunate to have had that chance to work on some of the greenest buildings in Canada, if not the world. And I guess my experience, you know, prior to moving to Vancouver, a lot of the work that I did was primarily, it was quite varied, but a lot of kind of residential, commercial, some industrial work. But now I almost exclusively deal with kind of institutional buildings across the government and culture sector. So rec centers, childcare, new fire halls, city halls, you name it. And then also quite a large portfolio of aviation projects as well. So lots of experience, lots of part experience. Yeah.
That's comprehensive. And that's a robust background. And I think one of the things that stands out to me, one of the things that I hear you saying that stands as a bit of a contradistinction to some of the language that I hear is you decided that you wanted to work on some of the greenest buildings, the future. 10 years ago, you're like, I want to lead. I want to be on the edge. And I want to work with clients that want to push the envelope and see what's possible. Which I'm actually really impressed by, because one of the pushbacks that I hear so often as just a murmuring in the industry is, oh, we can't. Oh, it's about budgets. Oh, and everyone's talking about the lowest common denominator. I actually had it was a very insightful conversation with a city planner, and it was over the counter, and we were talking honestly, and he was asking for me to guide him through how to build to step four, step five, because I'm an energy advisor, licensed builder, passive house designer. I care about green buildings, but my business as a contractor is fixing brand new buildings that break, they fall into decay. And we have some building science conflicts happening right now, and people are going to use 2x8 construction and put R32 in the walls. And I think it's going to be a disaster for homes. And he's saying, okay, well, what would you do? Because they want to make a bulletin that go out across all the municipalities in the interior of BC. And I started talking about exterior insulation, and as soon as I got to rain screen, he's like, you can't do that. Like that's more expensive. There's nobody who will accept that. His apprehension was that's better. I understand why, but nobody is willing to go that extra step to do those extra pieces to make that system acceptable. And it painted a rather bleak picture of what the industry is. General morale and motivation is. And then I hear your conversation, and it starts with, I just decided who I was going to work for, and I just narrowed right in on that. And it sounds like you've had a thriving career.
Yeah, I guess, you know, to each their own, right? You make what you want of your career. I mean, I have to admit, when I did start my career off in the interior, I was basically, I'd like to think of it as the forefront of change, right? You're fighting the good fight. You're trying to convince people, you know, how to go beyond just doing the code minimum. But I think the one thing that's important to also realize is that just that, the code has definitely taken the steps, and pardon the pun, but BC Energy Step Code in what it is, that policy kind of tool has essentially created, to some extent, parity across the province in terms of its implementation, or at least what's the expectations are. And by 2032, we're basically going to be building passive house, you know, levels of construction, like the envelope details are basically going to be performing at that level. So the people that choose to kind of say, no, why do I have to do it? There's no industry acceptance. I think there's a reckoning coming, and it's going to happen much sooner than they think. But I mean, that isn't to say that there aren't people out there in the development community, and I'm talking both public and private, that are doing their own education. One of the things that I also do is I'm a part-time instructor at BCIT in their high performance building lab, and they have a whole slew of different micro-credential programs as well as courses that are geared around kind of passive house, high performance buildings, and, you know, teaching trades, builders, you know, you name it, contractors, designers, in terms of kind of what to expect, looking at the nitty gritty of design and detail. My focus primarily is on the mechanical elements of that course, but, you know, it's really refreshing to see, and I've seen, you know, developers, builders from the interior, including Kelowna, come out and educate themselves because they're like, yeah, we're doing this. You know, we're choosing to take that step forward, knowing very well that it can be a risky step, but it's because they have that foresight. They see the change coming. They want to learn to adapt, maybe make a few mistakes along the way, but at least they'll be able to build it better the next time. And by the time it becomes mandatory for them, it's like no big deal.
You know what? And I'm seeing that too. Like I'm part of a group called Building Science and Beers. We meet monthly. You know, we're just a bunch of dudes from different industries that hang out.
I know Darren. Darren Sentesi. When I go way back, when I used to live in Kelowna, he used to be the, you know, both of us used to volunteer through the Cascadia Green Building Council. So I know Darren quite well and get the invite to BSS or BSBS.
Yeah, BSBS, Building Science Bears. And I love that there are people out there that we just care about this. And every time I have a conversation with these folks, men and women, you know, they reference their kids and their grandkids. And then that's the why. And it's not negotiable anymore. They're like, if a client came and said, I want to build a code minimum, whatever, they're like, not for us. I'm sorry. Like we're moving past that because there's almost like a sense of responsibility that comes out of them, because it's totally possible. We have the technology to build passive house or net zero today. We don't need another decade to warm up to it. It's just refreshing to be in that company.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, you know, sometimes, and I guess that's part of the reason why I chose to move to Vancouver, is because I was noticing definitely a trend occurring, particularly in Vancouver, around, you know, kind of the green building movement, and, you know, the uptake here being far, not to brag or to differentiate from other municipalities, but, you know, the city of Vancouver's policies have always been incredibly progressive. And, and I felt like for me to be able to be a credible kind of source in being able to spread that, you know, outside of just, you know, Vancouver or, you know, wherever I'm practicing, you have to have enough background and experience to be able to share that with the world, to share that knowledge so that they feel at ease with the fact that, you know, they're about to undertake something that they've never done before. And so I think, you know, in that realm, I too, and I fully agree with you, I often think about my family. I have a fairly young family, but I did recently, I want to say it was last year's passive house. It was actually a BuildX 2022. I was giving a presentation with another colleague of mine at HCMA Architecture and Design. We were basically talking about a whole slew of kind of, you know, part three passive houses, complex passive houses, and the success stories behind them. And she kind of set up the slides and actually said, you know, talk, like, give me a few adjectives about what makes you unique. And one of the adjectives where I was like, I don't know if this is so much an adjective, but it's just more so a defining feature, is that I'm a parrot. And that really is what defines my kind of path towards wanting this better future, right? It's like, it was a huge reason why I became an engineer, was to leave the world in a better place. And, you know, I'm doing that through the work that I'm doing. So, I guess it's incredibly fulfilling when you get to fight the good fight.
Yeah, because your kids are going to inherit what we leave behind, especially in infrastructure, which is lasting quite a long time.
Totally. Yeah. One of our most recent high-performing buildings that we just completed is Fire Hall 17. And I remember taking my son, actually just over the summer, right after, you know, about a couple months into occupancy, and taking him in. Aside from the fact that he just loves fire halls, I was trying to explain to him that this is going to be a building that's going to last for about 80 years. And it'd be so cool to drive by this in 80 years and see how well it stands. And I mean, when you've got such a robust building envelope that likely will need little to no maintenance over the long term, it'll truly be a testament of time. But something to look forward to.
Well, and he's going to get the opportunity too, 80 years from now, look back and going, I walked here with my dad, like the summer this opened, and he might have his grandkids there and go, look, my dad was part of this.
Yeah.
Why don't you walk us into a little bit, like Fire Hall 17, tell us about that project and what made it special.
Yeah. So this was particularly an interesting one. It was back in 2016, quite not too far from the time where the city of Vancouver actually amended its green building rezoning policy, and its own, and in fact, its own requirements to consider not just LEED Gold as a basis of design, but also Passive House certification. And so this project was the first project the city undertook that was a municipal non-residential Passive House project, and probably one of the most complex at the time in Canada. And so, you know, it's essentially looking at redeveloping an existing site, an incredibly tight site, to put a much larger hall in its place. And ultimately, it was one where, you know, through the design, through, you know, a lot of consultation with the owner group, you know, looking at really kind of driving down the energy, and through a lot of the experience that actually I had on a prior fire hall, where we convinced one of the Gulf Islands, Hornby Island Fire Hall, to consider Passive House as a design basis.
Yeah.
For its, I guess, for its construction, you know, we were able to see, you know, firsthand how, you know, low energy it was using. And so eventually it became this very easy kind of conversation around, well, why don't we consider net zero energy? Why don't we start also considering zero carbon? This is a fully electric, Passive House certified or pending certification. It's just, I guess, in the documentation period to finalize things, but, you know, it's nailed its air tests.
Yeah.
Positive thing. But it's, you know, it's an incredibly high performing building, and we're just coming up on a year's worth of energy data. You know, there's so many different design elements to the project to highlight. I don't even know where to begin. I am, I guess, presenting in Hamilton at the PESFest conference this year, touching on the post-occupancy evaluation. So maybe just a plug here if people are willing to make the trip out to Hamilton or Ontario for the 2023 conference. I'll be there. I'll be presenting and touching on that.
Shamelessly plug it, because here's the deal. Like, for people that, like, this is a net zero to hero podcast. Cause I remember I started at zero. Like, I was that zero guy, like the builder that just didn't care. And why do we have to air seal anything? And acoustical sealant sucks. And so this whole podcast is marking my journey, because I know I'm not the only one. Some of us feel like it's inevitable and we got to learn it in order to play in the industry anyways, because the step code. But then there's other of us that are waking up to the fact that, you know, again, our kids are going to inherit what we leave behind, and there's this agency. But this is just marking little steps on the journey. If you want to get immersed in something, go to a conference that's centered around Passive House and talk to a bunch of people that have been in the industry. And that is how you take a quantum leap forward. So by all means, plug away.
Yeah, no. And those conferences are great, because, you know, over the past 5-6 years, the conference has kind of grown from not just kind of looking at really only what was largely a lot of residential projects, but then, you know, it started to transform and morph to really incorporate the vast slew of different and often complex projects that have come out of there. So, you know, that's often one of the big kickers is like, although I've taught a lot of the courses and often a lot of the people that have come in are, you know, Part 9 builders and designers, and they're very used to, you know, working with wood frame construction and certain ways of doing things. There's this whole slew of other students and educators that are kind of like, well, we need more information around the Part 3 buildings and all the various different and often complex building materials that we look at integrating, because it's not longer just wood frame. We're looking at, you know, mass timber. We're looking at sometimes a hybrid between mass timber and steel and even concrete. And we're no longer looking at just, you know, punch windows. We're looking at curtain wall and how that integrates into the whole thing. And often the form is a little bit more articulated. And so, you know, definitely some more complex details and all of that, you know, is possible by knowledge sharing in the community. And if we don't have that, if we don't have, you know, the conferences to come together and learn from each other to be able to then kind of connect with and say, hey, I really like what you did there. Can you come over and teach us? Or we could use them like you on our team. That's where, I think there's a lot of success in that, right?
And just for context, some of our listeners, Part 3 buildings are commercial buildings or a home that's more than 6,000 square feet. Part 9 buildings in British Columbia are residential construction, everything up to 6,000 square feet. Am I dissecting that?
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah, I think some of the row home, like townhomes that are all like row home configuration, like terraces, sometimes they... depending, we may push like the 6,000 square foot range a little beyond that. But I think other than that, yeah, you're right. It's kind of smaller end.
And more to the conference side, and just one of the things that I've really been advocating for in this podcast, these conversations, is I think there's owners out there that have a vision for they want to do something different. But when you pull up the Google machine, you're sent in so many different directions. One of the things that I'm so happy about is you go to a conference like this, you get to see what people have done, and you get to find people that catch your vision, and you get to talk to them directly or at least see the firms. Like, because I just had an interview with a local mechanical contractor, and I can tell you, not all mechanical contractors are the same. Some are progressive and visionary in their approach. Others are prehistoric. And you need to find the people in the industry that are moving in the direction to partner with your vision, especially if you're building a new home these days. It's in the millions of dollars category. And so there's a lot at stake. Finding the right trades, the right professionals really matters. That's what I've discovered.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's not too long ago. It's been about a year now that CleanBC had released its roadmap to 2030 policy paper, which really outlines, you know, what sort of broad policy strokes they're looking at implementing by 2030. And you'd be surprised how many of those are actually geared towards anyone who's essentially within the mechanical industry, be it a trade or a designer. There's some broad strokes, and some of those broad strokes particularly tie around, you know, any space heating equipment sold and installed by 2030 needs to have a COP of 1, which COP, for reference, coefficient of performance, essentially a measure of efficiency for equipment, meaning, you know, COP of 1 is 1 unit of energy in equals 1 unit of energy out. So think of an electric baseboard. By virtue of that policy statement, basically it's asking for, you know, electric based heating. So it's either, you know, baseboard heating, or electric mat, or
and as the base minimum, like baseboard would be the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, totally. And that's really, you know, if you're going, you know, because we're, you know, incredibly lucky to have near zero carbon electricity in BC, you know, that's why there was a huge push to look at electrifying the built environment, and to make a move away from, you know, fossil fuels. Now, there's a lot of people out there that are going to say, well, you can't put heat pumps in, you know, in Kelowna or even places that are much colder than that, like further north. And to some extent, they're right. Like, you can, don't get me wrong, you can. You just have to find ways of backing it up so that when that heat pump starts to struggle, when it gets too cold out, you have some means of still providing heat. Either it's an electric coil, or you could maybe do gas as a backup.
Dual fuel system for those extreme climate conditions, a couple of weeks of the year.
That's right. But the thing to be mindful of, though, is, you know, again, going back to the STEP code, you know, by 2030, we're essentially going to be, you know, designing buildings that are using roughly about 90% of the energy that they're supposed to be, right? And just by building a better building, we're already taking a massive step towards decarbonizing the built environment, right? And so by doing that, you know, that incremental carbon amount to just heat the building becomes far less than, you know, what it would have been if we were building, you know, just standard, you know, stick frame building that, you know, didn't even really meet any measure of the code, right?
Yeah. 2018 building code, that base house there.
Yeah, that's right. And so as a result, I think it's like, it's not like it's going to, I don't think gas is fully going to disappear. I think that, you know, there are products out there that are going to still be geared towards that market. Like, there are gas heat pumps that, instead of using electricity to fire the compressor, they rely on natural gas instead to fire. And so as a result, I think that, you know, there's going to be, it's going to be gradual, it's going to be stepped. But I think by then too, you'll find that maybe heat pump technology is going to be far better. Maybe they found a way to crack below minus 30. I mean, that's because they're constantly looking at the evolution of refrigerants and what they're capable of getting out of the vapor compression cycle, right? So it's a great and exciting time to be like reading up on what you can do to keep your skills relevant, because I think a lot of mechanical contractors are probably going to need to, in like, if I could provide some advice to the mechanical contracting industry, is, you know, maybe think about trading in your gas ticket to get a refrigeration ticket, right? Or get that refrigeration ticket really soon, because there's a lot of incentives out there to look at, you know, like BC Hydro, and I'm sure Fortis have a lot of plugs out there right now to get people to install heat pumps. That's just the beginning, right? They're just trying to look at doing what they can. And then, and of course, by 2030, it's going to be nothing but that, right? So I think you'd be hard pressed to try to do it all at the same time later on. And I think now is the time to be positioning yourself to get ready to take on that work later.
I think that's a strong strategic incentive. I think we just offered some people there. We're talking about heat. It's interesting. We live in Canada. It gets cold. We think that way. But, you know, more and more, we're talking about overheating. And it's become a concern. People are dying. The heat domes are becoming more of the vernacular of the news is changing. Overheating, brand new homes, well-insulated homes, overheating. Can you speak to that at all as an expert in mechanical?
Absolutely. I don't live in a single family home. I do live in a condo and one that doesn't have cooling. So I can definitely speak from that perspective. I know that.
Speak experientially.
Yeah, I can tell you that, you know, it's not comfortable when you're, you know, in your home and it's cooking and you can see the temperature, you know, rise beyond 30, 35 degrees in your home, and you've got a fan blaring at all full speed, and you know you don't have any form of real AC in your home, especially because, you know, in some cases, Stratus don't even allow you to install, you know, a certain type of AC unit because it might impact the exterior condition, right? So, you know, I do have a bit of a success story that I can share, is that one of the projects that we had worked on, which is the Clayton Heights Community Center, you know, that was at the time one of the largest passive house projects to get completed, located in Clayton Heights, neighborhood of Surrey. You know, that project was completed just before the end of the pandemic, beginning of the pandemic. And it was kind of going through its first year of occupancy. And of course, during the pandemic, so it was a bit reduced in terms of occupancy, but, you know, that's right around the time where we all experienced the heat dome. And, you know, interestingly enough, you know, we were doing a lot of post-occupancy evaluations on that space, and actually, you know, again, shameless plug, that Hamilton at the conference, the Passive House conference, I'm actually going to be presenting with my colleagues who are also going to be talking about some of the post-occupancy evaluations of that building. But one of the success stories, going back to Clayton, one of the success stories on that is during the heat dome, we have infrared shots of the skylight glazing, and you can see that the temperature on the skylight's registering like close to 40 degrees, but that building has essentially radiant panels, heating and cooling panels integrated into the ceiling to help kind of keep the space cool. And it's a very low-tech system because it's just basically a panel that circulates fluid through it.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, we've got a shot of, you know, the hot window. And next to that, we've got, you know, the panel, and the panel shows that it's, you know, operating at just over, you know, 18 degrees. And the space temperature inside the space is a nice comfortable 24 degrees, right? And you think about the resiliency in that, you know, when you've got a well-insulated building and you've got just a little bit of cooling, you're able to really weather out some of the storms. And I think that, speaking more so to individual homeowners, I think everyone can empathize with the fact that it was incredibly hot, right? I think we all were, you know, exceeding, you know, anywhere between 10 to 15 degrees what our seasonal temperatures were. And I don't doubt that a lot of people after that summer went out and bought heat pump because they're like, I still got to heat my home. Heat pump does both. Why not? Right?
Yeah. Best of both worlds in that sense. Rather than buying a heater and an air conditioner, you put them to
use. Yeah. And it's actually really easy to retrofit an existing furnace to allow for, because that furnace would have probably had the capacity to be able to put in a coil for cooling. And so that same coil can do both heating and cooling. And you still have that backup furnace gas fired in case that heat pump's just struggling in the wintertime. So again,
totally.
That's where it's an easy retrofit, you know, depending on how old your furnace is and if it has enough fan power to get past that coil. Honestly, it's a no-brainer. You know, we're finding that, in fact, on most of the projects that we work on now, we're actually preempting the conversation with the owner to say, look, your code design temperature, say, you know, in Vancouver, for instance, like 29 degrees, the VBBL, the Vancouver Building Bylaw, actually has tables for 2050 and 2080 data to say these are what your temperatures are to design for. And we ask the question, say, should we be looking at designing for 2050, 2080? You know, especially in the municipal context, when you're building a building for like by at least a 6-year timeline, if not more, it's a no-brainer.
Let's think ahead.
Yeah, to think ahead, let's design for that hotter temperature. And a lot of the different municipalities are saying, yeah, no, for sure, we need to, right? If not, allow for the infrastructure in the building to support that so that in later, you know, as a retrofit project, they can put in bigger cooling units to handle that load, because it's not like it goes without incremental costs, right? More cooling means sometimes bigger pipes, bigger fans, bigger, you know, compressors, you name it, right? And that stuff's not cheap right now.
No, it's not.
Yep. But
I think the infrastructure is worth it. You know, I hear this, oh, it's so expensive. You know, I where in my world where I see people, it's like, I can get away with OSB, it meets code. Plywood's a little bit more money, I'll go with the OSB. But I'm like, yeah, but when OSB gets wet, it seals itself shut and traps all the moisture in the wall cavity and causes mushrooms to grow on your walls. Plywood, when it gets wet, expands, increases in permeability, so it breathes better, dries out your wall cavity. It's like built-in resilience. Spend a little bit more money up front. Your $1 million house is worth it, would be the advocation. You know, it's me plugging what I would advise homeowners to do. Anticipate the future a little bit, build in some resilience. There are incremental costs, as you've alluded to, these better systems, but I think the infrastructure deserves the investment is what I'm trying to say. We're not building cheap things anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You're spending so much money to build your brand new home. Why not just pay a little bit better for, you know, a product, especially considering that for a lot of people, their home is like the biggest investment that they're going to be making in their lifetime, right? So I think, you know, those incremental costs sometimes aren't very much in the grand scheme of it. And I think that's also the other big item is often when we're looking at the cost, we're just looking at the upfront cost. We don't really look at, you know, the net present value of something over the life of the building, right?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people get a little overwhelmed with, you know, the math behind that. But that's often something that I preach in my class when I do teach it is it doesn't take a lot of math to learn how to do a net present value calculation. And you often, because it's often the builders that work hand in hand with someone at the, you know, the owner to build, you know, their dream home, right? And it's like, you know, if you know there's something better to do and you're trying to convince the owner, sometimes just telling them isn't enough. They need to see the math behind it, right? And and if you're able to learn how to do some of that simple math and just show them why it makes sense in the long term, it's easy to be able to kind of show them up front that's how much you're saving and this is why, you know, this makes a lot of sense, right? And yeah, I think that's really how you can win over an owner and ultimately have, you know, a referral for life, right?
Well, and, you know, for all the builders that are out there just like me, net present value, what does that mean? Well, just the other month, I was in a finance class for my MBA, and net present value, your Excel spreadsheet has it built in there as a function, and you can YouTube how to do net present value calculations inside of Excel, so you don't got to go buy a fancy financial calculator. So I think it is, I'm saying to the builder, it's an approachable set of math equations that can provide the clarity that you're discussing. The client needs why am I justifying 5% more or 10% more when you look at it over the lifetime of the building? It often makes sense because the operating costs are real, and the cost of remediation is something that's often not looked at upfront.
Yeah, especially because, you know, they've got insurance, right? And so if you've got insurance, you know, the insurance company's handling that. But Tony, you know, last year I dealt with a flood in my condo, and so it gave me an opportunity to get real deep into like understanding, oh, you know, a little water leak in a wall, what did that mean? And, you know, it was easily like $25,000 worth of cost. And really that was being driven by the fact that we had to relocate a family, move them into a hotel room for basically a month, get all their stuff moved out, rip out the floors, hold up. Yeah, there's a lot that goes into just something as simple as that. And even
if insurance covers that cost, think about the family now has to live in a hotel room. The hotel room's paid for, but now the commute from the hotel room with your kids, that's not paid for. pain in the butt, the heartache.
Yeah, the stress alone is like probably, you know, amount to that too, right?
And I live in a world where I get to see what is declined as warrantable coverage and the heartache. It's still broken. It's just not getting paid for. So I like having that insurance will cover me. I wouldn't count on that as like a blanket.
Oh, totally. No, I totally agree with you. You know, and that's very much a real thing. It's like, again, you have to consider weigh out the cost benefit of, you know, paying a little bit more for the better insurance versus the not so much, you know.
Yes. Or even just the BC Housing standard home insurance, like the 2-5-10-year warranty. I mean, there's just some strict policy limitations and so many things. I see so much heartbreak in homeowners when they just, this what covered. But that's not what this is about. I'm actually really curious. Now, Scott, there's a couple of different, I'm going to say, stakeholders in the building and infrastructure place. There's the tradespeople, the mechanical contractors, or perhaps the builders. I would love to hear your guidance for them. And then I'd also love to hear your guidance for owners, people that are in the concept stage, imagining a vision for their either residential or commercial property. They should be considering different things. They're on the same team, but what would your guidance be for each of those audiences?
I imagine you're kind of asking in the context of like building a high performance building, right?
Absolutely. Those people want to do something beyond code.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really comes down to like, you know, what is your incentive? Like, what is driving that desire, right? I think if you're like they, as I think, you know, maybe speaking first to the owner themselves, right? Like for them, you know, they're the ones that are ultimately making the decision and have vision, right?
Yeah.
They can build whatever they want. It then comes down to, you know, do they want to build just, you know, code, or do they have an ambition or a desire to want to go beyond that, right? I mean, I think that there's enough science there to show that planet's health isn't so great. And, you know, we have the skill and expertise and the know-how to be able to deliver better buildings that not only help reduce the environmental burden, but also, you know, think about the occupational health burden of people that will inevitably live in that building in the long term, right? So I think that it comes down to, you know, what is the incentive? What is the desire for them? And also sometimes for people, especially developers, it's like, where's the branding? Where's the value in potential resale, right? I think buyers are becoming particularly more conscious about what it is that they're investing in and purchasing. And if they can see that, oh, I have an opportunity to live in a building that is going to be potentially using far less energy, and likely will see far less maintenance compared to, say, the next building that happens to be a little bit cheaper, well, maybe I'll pay a little bit more because, again, this is a building that I'm going to be paying a lot more for. Or, sorry, this is probably the biggest, you know, financial decision I make in my life. Why not put in a little bit more money to get a better product that will likely also have a higher resale value?
Absolutely, especially as the cost utilities increase and those, like, you know, when the energy audit on your home becomes part of the sale package and influences what people are willing to bid on your for sale sign.
Yeah. And my brother, actually, my brother is, he works in finance. He works for a commercial lender. And what he does, you know, and what he does is he actually works to help, like, administer CMHC loans to, you know, different developers for rental housing. And like, there's criteria out there around, for instance, just on the rental house side, you know, the better the building is built, like, the more incentives sometimes they're able to qualify for, right? So that, again, right now, especially in a time where securing financing is particularly tough, that's an incentive for owners to consider, especially if they really want to move forward with building their homes, right? And so that's just one thing to consider. And then I think for when it comes to kind of the trades, and particularly the builders, I often say that the adversarial approach that we've often taken in construction between, you know, often a designer or a consultant and the trades and the sub-trades, the builder, doesn't allow for and often creates a breakdown in what that finished product is. Either be it they don't understand your complex detail and they're banging their heads against the wall saying, we don't do this, we're not going to do this, like, we're just going to do what we do and, you know,
take it or leave it, you can't find other trades anyways.
Yeah, exactly. Especially right now, now's the time for people to really spend on educating yourselves, right? I think that, you know, over the past few years, there's been a lot of changes and even more recently, there's broad policy kind of implementation that's pointing towards rapid change, right? The whole idea behind the SEP code, for instance, is that with each iteration of the building code that gets released between now and 2032, each one of those steps basically drops off and the next step becomes your base, right? And by 2032, step 5 for part 9 or step 4 for commercial buildings is going to be the base. And so the sooner that people adopt that mentality and are able to implement it, you know, we'll be able to create that market transformation whereby eventually the suppliers will just say, well, I don't have a need to sell double pane glass anymore. You know, triple
option
that's out there. And so the availability and possibly the cost, you know, around that is going to come down, similar to how, you know, solar panels are, you know, incredibly cheap and abundant now. And so I think that, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see that market uptake be significantly higher. And I think now is the time for people to educate themselves, to better position themselves for the work that's coming up. Because, you know, by 2030, we're not just going to be building better buildings, but then we're addressing the next big elephant in the room, which is the, you know, the massive existing building stock that continues to be the worst emitters, you know, out there, right?
Yeah.
And so there's going to be a need for us to not just look at building new buildings well, but how can we take an existing building with its own kind of messy and complex issues to make it a better building? Right. Kind of like you're a fake Brandon, right? You know, you're getting asked by owners to come in and fix your problems. Well, I think there's going to be a lot more of that coming up.
Lots more. I see a tidal wave coming. Yep, for sure. Yeah. Especially as building wall systems become more complex and people try to adhere to the way they've always done it. I think we're actually going to run into some building science issues where the thermal dynamics just work against the way we always did it. I think we're at a threshold where you can't do it the old way and expect durable results anymore. Yeah, which is why I advocate for exterior insulation. And yes, there's a rain screen attached to that so you can hang your cladding and all the things. Just the way we do thermal barriers just needs to change. Yeah, which is fun. I'm really curious, Scott. You've done so well to articulate some of the themes, the trends. I hear optimism. I hear passion. I hear deep knowledge. I love that you're with BCIT. You're training people. Like, you're literally taking the generation of visionary tradespeople and saying, this is how we practically do this. This is what we need to consider. And I know that sometimes there's going to be people that aren't actually going to be able to work with you because there's some good folks in Winnipeg, you know, that want to, you know, plan a building in their vicinity. And how do they go about finding folks like yourself, other professionals? How would you guide them to know whether they're getting into the process with people that will steward their vision in a way that they're going to be happy with at the finished product?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. There is a lot of greenwashing happening
in our industry. There is. A lot of shenanigans.
Yeah. I actually just recently saw in the news that European Union's like putting through policy to actually look at combating that and finding companies that make greenwashing statements.
Good.
But I guess to that point, how do you actually, you know, that's interesting that you say that, because I think it comes down to really like sticking to proven or well-established, you know, not-for-profits like your green building councils, like your Canadian green building councils, US green building councils, a really interesting resource that you may want to share with your listeners is the Zero Energy Building Exchange, ZEBEX, which is actually funded through the city of Vancouver. And its mission is really to help promote, you know, the transformation of the industry and the knowledge sharing towards, you know, a zero energy future or zero carbon future. And so I think it's really, some of that is just, you know, diving deep and reading about what people are doing, right? You look up high performance buildings, you look up passive house construction, you look up zero carbon. Yeah, there is a lot out there and there's a lot of different projects that claim there's zero carbon, but they're not necessarily getting certified. So it's kind of like, you know, a metric they've kind of set and they found a way to justify it in their own minds. And then there's also kind of the way where you can get it certified to show that you've gone through the rigor of proving that it meets a standard that's internationally or nationally recognized. And I think that if you stick by those kind of, you know, venues like Passive House Canada being another one, there's a lot of different guides and resources and the communities within them. Right. If you get plugged in, the communities within them, it's really easy when you start talking to them that you realize like, oh, have you not heard about, you know, ZEBEX? Have you not heard about, you know, BDE building, BDE is another building electrification group here in Vancouver. And, you know, they're all, you know, same, it's the same group of people that all talk to each other ultimately.
Totally.
And, you know, the moment you start kind of getting connected in the community and getting yourself involved, I think that's when you start to realize like, all the different resources that are there and available at your fingertips. And you won't be able to do that unless you kind of go down that rabbit hole of trying to read about it and identifying kind of organizations and non-for-profit organizations where their mandate is just to spread that news, right? And to share knowledge share. And so I can't stress enough starting there. Already listed a few there. If I can think of some more, I'll try to share them, but they're great resources. And the moment you kind of connect with them or reach out to them and you tell them what you're looking for, they'll be able to kind of say, oh yeah, like when it comes to consultants or when it comes to architects, these are the people you should be talking to, right? It's really easy to be able to do that.
And further to that, Scott, I mean, here we are in a podcast, but yeah, I'm going to speak to the audience about you for a moment. You know, I pick up the phone months back and I was in Calgary. I had a client that had a question. He wanted to electrify his home, get an electric furnace out, and I got referred to you. And so I don't know you at that point. You know, you were gracious enough to answer the phone call. We spent several minutes on the phone, I think 15 or 20 or so. And one of the things that is very clear when you start talking to somebody that says that they're a professional in this industry is you can just hear their passion, their enthusiasm, the ease of conversation. They can start to see the relationships between their industry and other. Like, those were all clues to me that you're a consummate professional at what you do. We're not talking about a junior do-gooder that's trying to like look the part. It just, in that dialogue, you ask a couple of tough questions and they have some considerate answers and it's like, okay, all right, we're in the ballpark here. And those were things that drew me to you. Those are things that said, hey, listen, I know that there are people that need to hear what you're talking about, which is why we're here today.
Yeah. Well, I'll try not to blush there, Brent. Thanks for the compliment.
No, I'm not blowing smoke. I'm telling you the truth. That's good.
No, for sure. Well, I mean, like you said, I'm incredibly passionate about this. So it really, I'm here to help the industry out in any way I can. And so I'm happy to help. Curious who it was that referred you to.
Stefan Ames from All Elements Design.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's right. And I think him and I met at BuildX.
He did. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he came back. Yeah. He's like, you got to talk to this Scott guy.
Yeah.
Cause I was asking, well, I really respect him as a builder that puts the pieces together. He's a bit of a scientist on the job site. He's building 10,000 square foot net zero house, multi-generational. Like he's in it. And I said, who do you recommend for mechanical design? Because I was seeing that this is where the bottleneck was coming. It was at the time the heat domes are real things. People are trying to patch on cooling. We got heat pumps. People don't know how to bridge them. We're still got overheating happening. And I need somebody who was aware of how systems interacted. And I had this other client from that I did an energy audit for that wanted to do more solar panels and then started asking me about heat pumps. I'm like, he had such a complex home and he was so particular and what he wanted to do, he wanted to be completely net zero that I'm like, I need a mechanical, someone understands mechanical in a whole house system. Anyways, that's how I got to you way back when. So
nice.
Yeah, and
that was actually, I was just going to say when I used to live in Kelowna, that was actually one of the things that, you know, it's funny because before I had actually ventured down passive, like down doing the work for passive house, I was doing a lot of what you were doing, Brandon, I was doing energy studies, feasibility studies, but also just being a designer, you know, you do a lot of the, you know, heating, cooling load calculations. And I was working on a few higher end homes in the Kicking Horse area there, like in Fernie. And I was, you know, doing calculations and, you know, some of these homeowners were actually really tacking on higher levels of insulation. And I was noticing the significant reduction in the heating energy and the cooling needed for those buildings. Then I was doing the calculations and then I was like, huh, you know, this isn't very much. And then you look at how much ventilation air the home needed and you look at how much, you know, you're moving around the house and then you start doing some quick calculations like, you know, I might be able to actually heat this home just using my ventilation system and not really need any other systems.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, you know, you start like, you know, the engineering brain starts to kind of, you know, clunk away and you're like, hey, well, what if we knew this? But at the same time, you know, we're also working sometimes with owners where they're like, no, I want this, I want that. And, you know, their needs and wants sometimes clash with, I don't like to say it's like, you know, sometimes common sense or what could be done a lot more efficiently or like at lower cost.
Yeah.
And that's often one of the first things I have to talk about, like when we do passive houses, like you could do, you know, you could put a fireplace in your passive house, a gas fired fireplace or wood burning fireplace in your passive house, but you'll find that you'll probably not turn it on most of the time. As much as it's a want and a desire to put it in, you might realize that you don't really need it. And, you know, it's funny because I've had owners that have still built a passive house, put the thing in, and then years later you talk to them and they're like, yeah, I've never turned that thing on. It's just more good.
Yeah. Because there is a whole spectrum of client that does. We talk about the client that doesn't want to pay for triple pane windows. Then there's the client that wants to pay for every single bell and whistle under the sun. And I discovered, yeah, there are some things they just don't need to spend money on. Even if they have it to spend and they spec it, they want all these complex systems. What I hear you saying is sometimes you can actually be really intelligent about your system and make things integrated and efficient, and you can delete some extraneous equipment and then they go, nope, I want it anyways.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it helps, you know, if you're able to get rid of it, you're then able to kind of tunnel through the cost barrier and pay for, you know, some of the more expensive stuff that actually adds a lot more value to your home, right? If, you know, for instance, in a passive home, well insulated, maybe doing in-floor, you know, radiant heat, you know, hydronic based radiant heat, may not make the most sense, right? Like the system is slow reacting, passive houses heat up pretty quickly, you know, depending on the size of your home. And so, you know, by the time that thing heats up, it might actually overheat your home and never really maintain a comfortable, you know, condition. And you've paid so much money to run the pipes, the pumps, the expensive control system that tells the whole thing how to operate. Whereas you probably could put, you know, a simple split system, provide heating and cooling, make it a little bit more discreet, and it'll be able to kind of heat the home and cool the home a lot quicker than, right? And just because the idea that, oh, I want to have nice warm floors. Well, it's like, well, if you build a passive house, you're going to get pretty even surface temperatures throughout your home.
Anyway, so it's going to be a lot. Because you got insulation under the slab.
Yeah, you're going to have more comfortable conditions like than you would have probably previously imagined. And so it's really kind of breaking down the paradigms. And I think maybe, you know, thinking to your earlier question about what some advice you'd give to owners, it's keep, and maybe to all people involved, is be open and be ready to challenge a paradigm. Play devil's advocate and kind of say, yeah, you want this, but what if, right? Like, what if you were to consider, you know, an alternate? If we can convince firefighters to give up, you know, a gas-fired commercial stove and to, you know, do electric, you know, induction cooktops and still get the same level of, you know, performance and be able to cook as many meals for their crew as they would have previously, then why not, right?
Totally. And, you know, and I also would say to every homeowner, I would say, look at passive house. You know, even if you don't want to go through the certification of, like, you spend a bunch of money on the credentialing and the auditing and documentation process. But I would say absolutely look at them as a baseline and build off of their principles. You know, even if you're not going to hit it, hit something near it, like just aim at that target. And it's hard to go wrong when you're dealing with that as a kind of a safety net and guiding, because there's so much, they provide so much support.
Oh, totally. Fully agree with that. Like, following passive house but not getting it certified is basically like the equivalent of building a step four home, right? Or a step five home. So if anyone needs guidance, needs ideas for detailing and what that looks like, look no further. Through passive house, you'd probably be able to find enough resources on the internet to be able to give you guidance on how to design your home and what that level of performance is going to look like to help meet that level of step, right?
Yeah, I'm with you. I just, yeah. And they're always keen to share. There's like people that are passive house people are just pumped to advocate. They're just, it's a fun community. Yeah. You know, as we draw to the end here, any closing thoughts, anything that's pressing for you that you just think people, it would be important for them to know?
You know, as I look to the future, you know, I see a huge promising future around decarbonization. You know, I think we've done a great job of looking at operational carbon, which is like the emissions that go into, you know, keeping your buildings operational. So, you know, energy consumption. There's a lot of discussion right now around embodied carbon, which I'm incredibly passionate about. I think being from BC, you know, the use of wood is clearly a way for us in the built environment to look at reducing our embodied carbon. And, you know, again, broad policy strokes, it still talks about how, you know, municipalities need to be looking at reducing their carbon, embodied carbon emissions in their building stocks. And, you know, you look at other municipalities like the city of Vancouver that are going to be mandating developers to look at, you know, embodied carbon reduction targets for their new development. So I see that being the future. And so, you know, as a, you know, leaning thought to some of your audience members, it's start thinking about what embodied carbon is and what it isn't, so that you can start thinking about how this potentially could impact your developments, because it's definitely coming. And, you know, even for those that are already tuned in, know all about embodied carbon, I think, you know, aside from the structured enclosure discussion, there's this whole other elephant in the room, which is all the mechanical, electrical, plumbing systems, all the innards of the building that don't fit within the structured enclosures categories. Those particularly have an immense carbon footprint, embodied carbon footprint. And we've got a few research papers out there that show the difference between refrigerant-based systems, distributed refrigerant-based systems versus, you know, hydronic-based systems, and the impact that has on embodied carbon. And the biggest thing behind that is the fact that when you consider doing a life cycle analysis for your building, you know, that 6-year timeline, when you're looking at structure and enclosure, you're barely touching those elements over the course of their timeline. Whereas with mechanical systems, for instance, you're often replacing them maybe 2-3 times, anywhere between 1-3-4 times, like over the course of that life right? And so I think there's going to be a lot of different research coming out to help bring that to light. I wouldn't be surprised if that then starts to make it into more and more of the kind of green building standards to start looking at the whole building lifecycle analysis that not just includes structure and enclosure, but the rest of the innards. And yeah, so I think that's definitely another rabbit hole to go down and want to
consider yes.
where people have, you know, they're looking at building their buildings.
Scott, truly an honor today.
Yeah. Thank you for having me, Brandon.
Yeah, your generosity is so appreciated. And like, I find it inspiring. I mean, these dialogues are great as a general, but I'm like, this has been very good. It is lots to consider here. So thank you.
Likewise. Thanks for your time and for having me on your show. And it was a pleasure connecting with you and sharing my story.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.